Conservation laws and invariance principles are based on what physicists call symmetries. The fact that space is the same in all directions, isotropic, and in all places, homogeneous, is an example of symmetry. The fact that time is homogeneous is another example. These symmetries simply mean that a physics experiment performed in Boston this spring will give the same result as the same experiment performed in Moscow next fall. In other words, physicists now believe that the most fundamental laws of physics, the conservation laws and invariance principles, are based upon those foundations of our reality that are so basic that they go unnoticed. This does not mean, probably, that it has taken physicists 300 years to realize that moving an object, like a telephone, around the country does not distort its shape or size, space is homogeneous, nor does turning it upside down, space is isotropic, nor does letting it get 2 weeks older, time is homogeneous. Everyone knows that this is the way our physical world is constructed. Where and when a subatomic experiment is performed are not critical data. The laws of physics do not change with time and place. It does mean, however, that it has taken physicists 300 years to realize that the most simple and beautiful mathematical structures may be those that are based on these unobtrusively obvious conditions. Theoretical physics, roughly speaking, has branched into two schools. One school follows the old way of thinking, and the other school follows new ways of thinking. Physicists who follow the old way of thinking continue their search for the elementary building blocks of the universe in spite of the Hall of Mirrors predicament. For these physicists, the most likely candidate at present for the title of ultimate building block of the universe is the quark. A quark is a type of hypothetical particle theorized by Murray Gell-Mann in 1964. It is named after a word in James Joyce's book, Finnegan's Wake. All known particles, the theory goes, are composed of various combinations of a few, 12, different types of quarks. No one has found a quark yet, but many are looking. It is an extraordinarily elusive particle, as many now known particles were in the past, with some strange characteristics. For example, quarks are theorized to have 1/3 unit of electrical charge. Never before has charge been found in other than whole units. The great quark hunt could become very exciting in the near future, but no matter what is discovered in the future, one thing about it already is certain. The discovery of quarks will open an entirely new area of research, namely, what are quarks made of? The physicists who follow the new ways of thinking are pursuing so many different approaches to understanding subatomic phenomena that it is not possible to present them all. Some of these physicists feel that space and time are all that there is. According to this theory, actors, action, and stage are all manifestations of an underlying four-dimensional geometry. Others, like David Finkelstein, are exploring processes which lie beneath time, processes from which space and time, the very fabric of experiential reality, are derived. These theories at the moment are speculative. They cannot be proven, demonstrated mathematically. The most successful departure from the unending search for the ultimate particle syndrome is the S-matrix theory. In S-matrix theory, the dance, rather than the dancers, is of primary importance. S-matrix theory is different because it places the emphasis upon interactions rather than upon particles. S-matrix is short for scattering matrix. Scattering is what happens to particles when they collide. A matrix is a type of mathematical table. An S-matrix is a table of probabilities. When subatomic particles collide, several things usually are possible. For example, the collision of two protons can create 1, a proton, a neutron, and a positive pion; 2, a proton, a lambda particle, and a positive kaon; 3, two protons and 6 assorted pions; 4, numerous other combinations of subatomic particles. Each of these possible combinations, which are the combinations that do not violate the conservation laws, occurs with a certain probability. In other words, some of them occur more often than others. The probabilities of various combinations, in turn, depend upon such things as how much momentum is carried into the collision area. In an S matrix, all of these probabilities are tabulated in such a way that we can look up or calculate the possible results of any collision, along with their probabilities, if we know what particles initially collide and how much momentum they have. Of course, there are so many possible combinations of particles, each one of which can yield a variety of results, that a complete matrix, or table, containing all the probabilities of all the possible combinations of particles would be enormous. In fact, such a complete table has not been compiled. This is no immediate problem, however, since physicists are concerned only with a small part of the S matrix at any one time. For example, the part which deals with two proton collisions. Such parts of the total S matrix are called elements of the S matrix. The major limitation of S matrix theory is that at present it applies only to the strongly interacting particles, mesons and baryons, which as a group are called hadrons. Let's make an S matrix diagram of a subatomic interaction. It's very simple. The collision area is a circle. Particles 1 and 2 go into the collision area from below, and particles 3 and 4 come out of the collision area above. The diagram tells nothing about what happened at the point of collision. It shows only what particles went into the interaction and what particles came out of the interaction. An S matrix diagram is not a space-time diagram. It does not show the position of the particles in space or time. This is intentional because we do not know the exact positions of the interacting particles. We have chosen to measure their momenta, and consequently their position is unknown, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. For this reason, S matrix diagrams indicate only that an interaction took place in a certain area inside the circle. They are purely symbolic representations of particle interactions. Not all interactions involve only two initial particles and two final particles. For instance, three particles might enter the circle and two particles might leave. Or three particles might enter the circle and three particles might leave. Or two particles might enter the circle and three particles might leave. Like Feynman diagrams, S matrix diagrams can be rotated. For instance, when an S matrix diagram of a proton colliding with a negative pion to produce a proton and a negative pion is rotated, it becomes a diagram of a proton antiproton annihilation producing a negative pion and a positive pion. The positive pion is the antiparticle of the negative pion in the original reaction. Every time a diagram is rotated, it depicts another possible interaction. This particular S matrix diagram can be rotated four times. All of the particles that can be depicted by rotating a single element of the S matrix are intimately related to each other. In fact, all of the particles represented in an S matrix diagram, including those discovered by rotating the diagram, are defined in terms of each other. Which of them are elementary is a meaningless question. Since the particles resulting from an interaction often become involved in other interactions, separate elements of the S matrix can be assembled diagrammatically into a network of related interactions. Each network, as well as each interaction, is associated with a certain probability. These probabilities can be calculated. According to S matrix theory, particles are intermediate states in a network of interactions. The lines in an S matrix diagram are not the world lines of different particles. Lines in an S matrix diagram of an interaction network are reaction channels through which energy flows. A neutron, quote unquote, for example, is a reaction channel. It can be formed by a proton and a negative pion. If more energy is available, however, the same channel can be created by a lambda particle and a neutral kaon and several other particle combinations as well. In short, S matrix theory is based upon events, not upon things. Dancers no longer stand apart as significant entities. In fact, the dancers are not even defined except in terms of each other. In S matrix theory, there is only the dance. We've come a long way from Newton and his proverbial apple. Nonetheless, apples are a real part of the apparent world. When we eat an apple, we are aware of who is eating and what is being eaten as distinct from the action of eating. The idea that objects exist apart from events is part of the epistemological net with which we snare our particular form of experience. This idea is dear to us because we have accepted it without question as the basis of our reality. It profoundly influences how we see ourselves. It is the root of our inescapable sense of separateness from others and environment. The history of scientific thought, if it teaches us anything at all, teaches us the folly of clutching ideas too closely. To this extent, it is an echo of Eastern wisdom which teaches us the folly of clutching anything. Part 1. Enlightenment. Chapter 1. More Than Both. What does physics have in common with enlightenment? Physics and enlightenment apparently belong to two realms which are forever separate. One of them, physics, belongs to the external world of physical phenomena, and the other of them, enlightenment, belongs to the internal world of perceptions. A closer examination, however, reveals that physics and enlightenment are not so incongruous as we might think. First, there is the fact that only through our perceptions can we observe physical phenomena. In addition to this obvious bridge, however, there are more intrinsic similarities. Enlightenment entails casting off the bonds of concept, veils of ignorance, in order to perceive directly the inexpressible nature of undifferentiated reality. Undifferentiated reality is the same reality that we are a part of now, and always have been a part of, and always will be a part of. The difference is that we do not look at it in the same way as an enlightened being. As everyone knows, words only represent something else. They are not real things. They are only symbols. According to the philosophy of enlightenment, everything is a symbol. The reality of symbols is an illusory reality. Nonetheless, it is the one in which we live. Although undifferentiated reality is inexpressible, we can talk around it using more symbols. The physical world, as it appears to the unenlightened, consists of many separate parts. These separate parts, however, are not really separate. According to mystics from around the world, each moment of enlightenment, grace, insight, samadhi, satori, reveals that everything, all the separate parts of the universe, are manifestations of the same whole. There is only one reality, and it is whole and unified. It is one. We already have learned that understanding quantum physics requires a modification of ordinary conceptions, like the idea that something cannot be a wave and a particle. Now we shall see that physics may require a more complete alteration of our thought processes than we ever conceived, or in fact than we ever could conceive. Likewise, we previously have seen that quantum phenomena seem to make decisions, to know what is happening elsewhere. Now we shall see how quantum phenomena may be connected so intimately that things once dismissed as occult could become topics of serious consideration among physicists. In short, both in the need to cast off ordinary thought processes and ultimately go beyond thought altogether, and in the perception of reality as one unity, the phenomenon of enlightenment and the science of physics have much in common. Enlightenment is a state of being. Like all states of being, it is indescribable. It is a common misconception, literally, to mistake the description of a state of being for the state itself. For example, try to describe happiness. It is impossible. We can talk around it, we can describe the perspective and actions that usually accompany a state of happiness, but we cannot describe happiness itself. Happiness and the description of happiness are two different things. Happiness is a state of being. That means that it exists in the realm of direct experience. It is the intimate perception of emotions and sensations which, indescribable in themselves, constitute the state of happiness. The word happiness is the label or symbol which we pin on this indescribable state. Happiness belongs to the realm of abstractions or concepts. A state of being is an experience. A description of a state of being is a symbol. Symbols and experience do not follow the same rules. This discovery, that symbols and experience do not follow the same rules, has come to the science of physics under the formidable title of quantum logic. The possibility that separate parts of reality, like you and I and tugboats, may be connected in ways which both our common experience and the laws of physics belie, has found its way into physics under the name of Bell's theorem. Bell's theorem and quantum logic take us to the farthest edges of theoretical physics. Many physicists have not even heard of them. Bell's theorem and quantum logic currently are unrelated. Proponents of one seldom are interested in the other. Nonetheless, they have much in common. They are what is really new in physics. Of course, laser fusion, fusing atoms with high-energy light beams, and the search for quarks generally are considered to be the frontiers of theoretical physics. In a certain sense, they are. However, there is a big difference between these projects and Bell's theorem and quantum logic. Laser fusion research and the great quark hunt are endeavors within the existing paradigms of physics. A paradigm is an established thought process, a framework. Both quantum logic and Bell's theorem are potentially explosive in terms of existing frameworks. The first, quantum logic, calls us back from the realm of symbols to the realm of experience. The second, Bell's theorem, tells us that there is no such thing as separate parts. All of the parts of the universe are connected in an intimate and immediate way previously claimed only by mystics and other scientifically objectionable people. The central mathematical element in quantum theory, the hero of the story, is the wave function. The wave function is that mathematical entity which allows us to determine the possible results of an interaction between an observed system and an observing system. The celebrated position held by the wave function is due not only to Erwin Schrödinger, who discovered it, but also to the Hungarian mathematician John von Neumann. In 1932, von Neumann published a famous mathematical analysis of quantum theory called The Mathematical Foundations of Quantum Mechanics. In this book, von Neumann, in effect, asked the question, if a wave function, this purely abstract mathematical creation, actually should describe something in the real world, what would that something be like? The answer that he deduced is exactly the description of a wave function that we already have discussed. This strange animal constantly would change with the passage of time. Each moment it would be different from the moment before. It would be a composite of all the possibilities of the observed system which it describes. It would not be a simple mixture of possibilities. It would be a sort of organic whole whose parts are changing constantly, but which, nonetheless, is somehow a thing in itself. This thing in itself would continue to develop indefinitely until an observation or measurement is made on the observed system which it represents. If the observed system is a photon propagating in isolation, the wave function representing this photon would contain all of the possible results of the photon's interaction with a measuring device, like a photographic plate. For example, the possibilities contained in the wave function might be that the photon will be detected in area A of the photographic plate, that the photon will be detected in area B of the photographic plate, and that the photon will be detected in area C of the photographic plate. Once the photon is set in motion, the wave function associated with it would continue to develop, change, according to a causal law, the Schrödinger wave equation, until the photon interacts with the observing system. At that instant, one of the possibilities contained in the wave function would actualize, and the other possibilities contained in the wave function would cease to exist. They simply would disappear. The wave function, that strange animal that von Neumann was attempting to describe, would collapse. The collapse of this particular wave function would mean that the probability of one of the possible results of the photon measuring device interaction became one. It happened, and the probability of the other possibilities became zero. They were no longer possible. After all, a photon can be detected only in one place at a time. The wave function, according to this view, is not quite a thing, yet it is more than an idea. It occupies that strange middle ground between idea and reality, where all things are possible but none are actual. Heisenberg likened it to Aristotle's potentia. This approach has unconsciously shaped the language and therefore the thinking of most physicists, even those who consider the wave function to be a mathematical fiction, an abstract creation whose manipulation somehow yields the probabilities of real events which happen in real versus mathematical space and time. Needless to say, this approach also has caused a great deal of confusion, which is as unclear today as it was in von Neumann's time. For example, exactly when does the wave function collapse? The problem of measurement. Is it when the photon strikes the photographic plate? Is it when the photographic plate is developed? Is it when we look at the developed plate? Exactly what is it that collapses? Where does the wave function live before it collapses? And so on. This view of the wave function, that it can be described as a real thing, is generally the view of the wave function attributed to von Neumann. However, the real wave function description is only one of two approaches to understanding quantum phenomena, which he discussed in the Mathematical Foundations of Quantum Mechanics. The second approach, to which von Neumann devoted much less time, is a re-examination of the language by which it is necessary to express quantum phenomena. In the section Projections as Propositions, he wrote, "The relation between the properties of a physical system on the one hand and the projections, wave function, on the other, makes possible a sort of logical calculus with these. However, in contrast to the concepts of ordinary logic, this system is extended by the concepts of simultaneous decidability, the uncertainty principle, which is characteristic for quantum mechanics." This suggestion that the novel properties of quantum theory can be used to construct a logical calculus which is in contrast to the concepts of ordinary logic is what von Neumann considered the alternative to describing wave functions as real things. Most physicists, however, have adopted a third explanation of wave functions. They dismiss them as purely mathematical constructions, abstract fictions, which represent nothing in the world of reality. Unfortunately, this explanation leaves forever unanswered the question, how then can wave functions predict so accurately probabilities which can be verified through actual experience? In fact, how can wave functions predict anything when they are defined as completely unrelated to physical reality? This is a scientific version of the philosophical question, how can mind influence matter? Von Neumann's second approach to understanding the paradoxical puzzles of quantum phenomena took him far beyond the boundaries of physics. This brief work pointed to a fusion of ontology, epistemology, and psychology, which only now is beginning to emerge. "In short, the problem," said von Neumann, "is in the language. Herein lies the germ of what was to become quantum logic." In pointing to the problem of language, von Neumann put his finger on why it is so difficult to answer the question, what is quantum mechanics? Mechanics is the study of motion. Therefore, quantum mechanics is the study of the motion of quanta. But what are quanta? According to the dictionary, a quantum is a quantity of something. The question is, a quantity of what? A quantum is a piece of action. A piece of the action? The problem is that a quantum can be like a wave, and then again it can be like a particle, which is everything that a wave isn't. Furthermore, when a quantum is like a particle, it is not like a particle in the ordinary sense of the word. A subatomic particle is not a thing. We cannot determine simultaneously its position and momentum. A subatomic particle, quantum, is a set of relationships, or an intermediate state. It can be broken up, but out of the breaking come more particles as elementary as the original. "Those who are not shocked when they first come across quantum theory," said Niels Bohr, "cannot possibly have understood it." Quantum theory is not difficult to explain because it is complicated. Quantum theory is difficult to explain because the words which we must use to communicate it are not adequate for explaining quantum phenomena. This was well known and much discussed by the founders of quantum theory. Max Born, for example, wrote, "The ultimate origin of the difficulty lies in the fact, or philosophical principle, that we are compelled to use words of common language when we wish to describe a phenomenon, not by logical or mathematical analysis, but by a picture appealing to the imagination. Common language is grown by everyday experience and can never surpass these limits. Classical physics has restricted itself to the use of concepts of this kind. By analyzing visible motions, it has developed two ways of representing them by elementary processes, moving particles and waves. There is no other way of giving a pictorial description of motions. We have to apply it even in the region of atomic process where classical physics break down. This is the view currently held by most physicists. We encounter problems explaining subatomic phenomena when we try to visualize them. Therefore, it is necessary to forego explanations in terms of common language and restrict ourselves to mathematical analysis. To learn the physics of subatomic phenomena, we first must learn mathematics. Not so, says David Finkelstein, director of the School of Physics at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Mathematics, like English, is also a language. It is constructed of symbols. The best you can get with symbols is a maximal but incomplete description. A mathematical analysis of subatomic phenomena is no better qualitatively than any other symbolic analysis because symbols do not follow the same rules as experience. They follow rules of their own. In short, the problem is not in the language, the problem is the language. The difference between experience and symbol is the difference between mythos and logos. Logos imitates but can never replace experience. It is a substitute for experience. Logos is the artificial construction of dead symbols which mimics experience on a one-to-one basis. Classical physical theory is an example of a one-to-one correspondence between theory and reality. Einstein argued that no physical theory is complete unless every element in the real world has a definite counterpart in the theory. Einstein's theory of relativity is the last great classical theory, even though it is a part of the new physics, because it is structured in a one-to-one way with phenomena. Unless a physical theory has one-to-one correspondence with phenomena, argued Einstein, it is not complete. Whatever the meaning assigned to the term complete, the following requirement for a complete theory seems to be a necessary one. Every element of the physical reality must have a counterpart in the physical theory. Quantum theory does not have this one-to-one correspondence between theory and reality. It cannot predict individual events, only probabilities. According to quantum theory, individual events are chance happenings. There are no theoretical elements in quantum theory to correspond with each individual event that actually happens. Therefore, quantum theory, according to Einstein, is incomplete. This was a basic issue of the famous Bohr-Einstein debates. Mythos points toward experience, but it does not replace experience. Mythos is the opposite of intellectualism. Ceremonial chants and primitive rituals, like football games, are good examples of mythos. They endow experience with value, originality, and vitality, but they do not seek to replace it. Theologically speaking, logos is the original sin, the eating of the fruit of knowledge, the expulsion from the Garden of Eden. Historically speaking, logos is the growth of the literary revolution, the birth of the written tradition out of the oral tradition. From any point of view, logos, literally, is a dead letter. Knowledge, wrote E.E. Cummings, is a polite word for dead but not buried imagination. He was talking about logos. Our problem, according to Finkelstein, is that we cannot understand subatomic phenomena or any other kind of experience through the use of symbols alone. As Heisenberg observed, the concepts initially formed by abstraction from particular situations or experiential complexes acquire a life of their own. Getting lost in the interaction of symbols is analogous to mistaking the shadows on the wall of the cave for the real world outside the cave, which is direct experience. The answer to this predicament is to approach subatomic phenomena, as well as experience in general, with a language of mythos rather than a language of logos. Finkelstein put it this way. If you want to envision a quantum as a dot, then you are trapped. You are modeling it with classical logic. The whole point is that there is no classical representation for it. We have to learn to live with the experience. Question: how do you communicate the experience? Answer: you don't. But by telling how you make quanta and how you measure them, you enable others to have it. According to Finkelstein, a language of mythos, a language which alludes to experience but does not attempt to replace it or to mold our perception of it, is the true language of physics. This is because not only the language that we use to communicate our daily experience, but also mathematics, follows a certain set of rules, classical logic. Experience itself is not bound by these rules. Experience follows a much more permissive set of rules, quantum logic. Quantum logic is not only more exciting than classical logic, it is more real. It is based not upon the way that we think of things, but upon the way that we experience them. When we try to describe experience with classical logic, which is what we have been doing since we learned to write, we put on a set of blinders, so to speak, which not only restricts our field of vision, but also distorts it. These blinders are the set of rules known as classical logic. The rules of classical logic are well defined. They are simple. The only problem is that they do not correspond to experience. The most important difference between the rules of classical logic and the rules of quantum logic involves the law of distributivity. The law of distributivity, or the distributive law, says that A and B, or C, is the same as A and B, or A and C. In other words, I flip a coin and it comes up heads or tails has the same meaning as I flip a coin and it comes up heads, or I flip a coin and it comes up tails. The distributive law, which is a foundation of classical logic, does not apply to quantum logic. This is one of the most important but least understood aspects of von Neumann's work. In 1936, von Neumann and his colleague, Gerrit Birkhoff, published a paper which laid the foundations of quantum logic. In it, they used an example of a familiar, to physicists, phenomenon to disprove the distributive law. By so doing, they demonstrated mathematically that it is impossible to describe experience, including subatomic phenomena, with classical logic, because the real world follows different rules. The rules that experience follows, they called quantum logic. The rules which symbols follow, they called classical logic. Finkelstein uses a version of Birkhoff and von Neumann's example to disprove the law of distributivity. Finkelstein's demonstration requires only three pieces of plastic. These pieces of plastic are called polarizers, and of course the sunglasses which use them are called Polaroid sunglasses. Polarizers are a special kind of light filter. Most frequently, they are made of stretched sheets of plastic material in which all the molecules are elongated and aligned in the same direction. These long, slender molecules are responsible for the polarization of the light which passes through them. The polarization of light can be understood most easily as a wave phenomenon. Light waves from an ordinary light source, like the sun, emanate in every fashion, vertically, horizontally, and every way in between. This does not mean only that light radiates from a source in all directions. It means that in any given beam of light, some of the light waves are vertical, some of the light waves are horizontal, some are diagonal, and so forth. To a light wave, a polarizer looks something like a picket fence. Whether it can get through the fence or not depends upon whether it is aligned with the fence or not. If the polarizer is aligned vertically, only the vertical light waves make it through. All of the other light waves are obstructed. All of the light waves that pass through a vertical polarizer are aligned vertically. This light is called vertically polarized light. If the polarizer is aligned horizontally, only the horizontal light waves make it through. All of the other light waves are obstructed. All of the light waves that pass through a horizontal polarizer are aligned horizontally. This light is called horizontally polarized light. No matter how the polarizer is aligned, all of the light waves passing through it are aligned in the same plane. Taking one of the polarizers, we hold it so that the light coming through this polarizer is polarized vertically. Taking another polarizer, we hold it aligned the same way behind the first polarizer. Except for a slight attenuation due to the tint, all of the light that gets through the first polarizer also gets through the second polarizer. Now we rotate one of the polarizers from vertical to horizontal. As it is rotated, we notice that less and less light gets through the pair. When one of the polarizers is vertical and the other polarizer is horizontal, no light gets through them at all. The first polarizer eliminates all but the horizontally polarized light waves. They are eliminated by the second polarizer, which passes only vertically polarized light. The result is that no light passes both the vertical and the horizontal polarizer. It does not matter whether the first polarizer is vertical and the second polarizer is horizontal or the other way around. The order of the filters is not important. In either case, no light passes through them. Whenever two polarizers are oriented at right angles to each other, they block all light. No matter how the pair is twisted or turned as a unit, as long as they remain at right angles to each other, no light passes through them. With this in mind, we now come to the third filter. We align the third filter so that it polarizes light diagonally and place it in front of the horizontal polarizer and the vertical polarizer. Nothing happens. If the first two filters, the horizontal and the vertical polarizer, block all the light, the addition of a third filter, of course, scarcely can affect the situation. In a similar manner, if we place the diagonal polarizer on the other side of the horizontal-vertical combination, nothing happens. No light gets through the filters. Now we come to the interesting part. Put the diagonal polarizer between the horizontal and the vertical polarizer. Light gets through the three filters when they are placed in this order. In other words, a combination of horizontal and vertical polarizers is as much a barrier to light waves as a wooden door. A diagonal polarizer in front of or behind such a combination does not affect this phenomenon. However, if a diagonal polarizer is sandwiched in between the horizontal polarizer and the vertical polarizer, light gets through all three of them. Remove the diagonal polarizer, and the light disappears again. It is blocked by the combination of horizontal and vertical polarizers. How can this happen? According to quantum mechanics, diagonally polarized light is not a mixture of horizontally polarized light and vertically polarized light. We cannot simply say that the horizontal components of the diagonally polarized light pass through the horizontal polarizer and the vertical components of the diagonally polarized light passed through the vertical polarizer. According to quantum mechanics, diagonally polarized light is a separate thing in itself. How can a separate thing in itself get through all three filters but not through two of them? If we consider light as a particle phenomenon, this paradox becomes graphic. Namely, how can one photon be broken down into a horizontally polarized component and a vertically polarized component? By definition, it can't. This paradox is at the heart of the difference between quantum logic and classical logic. It is caused by our thought processes, which are following the rules of classical logic. Our intellect tells us that what we are seeing is impossible. After all, a single photon must be polarized one way or the other. Nonetheless, whenever we insert a diagonal polarizer between a horizontal polarizer and a vertical polarizer, we see light where there was none before. Our eyes are ignorant of the fact that what they are seeing is impossible. That is because experience does not follow the rules of classical logic. It follows the rules of quantum logic. The thing in itselfness of diagonally polarized light reflects the true nature of experience. Our symbolic thought process imposes upon us the categories of either or. It confronts us always with either this or that, or a mixture of this and that. It says that polarized light is either vertically polarized or horizontally polarized, or a mixture of vertically and horizontally polarized light. Thus are the rules of classical logic, the rules of symbols. In the realm of experience, nothing is either this or that. There is always at least one more alternative, and often an unlimited number of them. Finkelstein put it this way in reference to quantum theory. There are no waves in the game. The equation that the game obeys is a wave equation, but there are no waves running around. This is one of the mountains of quantum mechanics. There are no particles running around either. What's running around are quanta, the third alternative. To be less abstract, imagine that we have two different pieces from a chess set, say a bishop and a pawn. If these macroscopic chess pieces followed the same rules as quantum phenomena, we would not be able to say that there is nothing between being either a bishop or a pawn. Between the extremes of bishop and pawn is a creature called a bishon. A bishon is neither a bishop nor a pawn, nor is it half a bishop and half a pawn glued together. A bishon is a separate thing in itself. It cannot be separated into its pawn component and its bishop component any more than a puppy which is half collie and half German shepherd can be separated into its collie component and its German shepherd component. There is more than one type of bishon between the extremes of bishop and pawn. The bishon that we have been describing is one half part bishop and one half part pawn. Another type of bishon is one third part bishop and two thirds part pawn. Still another type of bishon is three-fourths part bishop and one-fourth part pawn. In fact, for every possible proportion of parts bishop to parts pawn, there exists a bishon which is quite distinct from all the others. A bishon is what physicists call a coherent superposition. A superposition is one thing or more imposed on another. A double exposure, the bane of careless photographers, is a superposition of one photograph on another. A coherent superposition, however, is not simply the superposition of one thing on another. A coherent superposition is a thing in itself, which is as distinct from its components as its components are from each other. Diagonally polarized light is a coherent superposition of horizontally polarized light and vertically polarized light. Quantum physics abounds with coherent superpositions. In fact, coherent superpositions are at the heart of the mathematics of quantum mechanics. Wave functions are coherent superpositions. Every quantum mechanical experiment has an observed system. Every observed system has an associated wave function. The wave function of a particular observed system, like a photon, is the coherent superposition of all the possible results of an interaction between the observed system and a measuring system, like a photographic plate. The development in time of this coherent superposition of possibilities is described by Schrödinger's wave equation. Using this equation, we can calculate the form of this thing in itself, this coherent superposition of possibilities, which we call a wave function, for any given time. Having done that, we then can calculate the probability of each possibility contained in the wave function at that particular time. This gives us a probability function, which is not the same as a wave function, but is calculated from a wave function. In a nutshell, that is the mathematics of quantum physics. In other words, in the mathematical formulations of quantum theory, nothing is either this or that, with nothing in between. Graduate students in physics routinely learn the mathematical technique of superimposing every this on every that in such a way that the result is neither the original this nor the original that, but an entirely new thing called a coherent superposition of the two. According to Finkelstein, one of the major conceptual difficulties of quantum mechanics is the false idea that these wave functions, coherent superpositions, are real things which develop, collapse, etc. On the other hand, the idea that coherent superpositions are pure abstractions which represent nothing that we encounter in our daily lives also is incorrect. They reflect the nature of experience. How do coherent superpositions reflect experience? Pure experience is never restricted to merely two possibilities. Our conceptualization of a given situation may create the illusion that each dilemma has only two horns, but this illusion is caused by assuming that experience is bound by the same rules as symbols.